Welcome back to another episode of Behavioral Threat Analysis Center, Beyond the Bulletin. I'm your host, Dr. Kristen Schneider, and I'm here with my co-host, Pete Lapp.
I'm Pete. Nice to see you again. We're in the same room once again, which is, it's always a treat. And it's very cool we can actually get into the same room together to do this. I really look forward to these.
It is. And this is a very special West Coast edition of our podcast.
Yep.
We are, in fact, at DSI West at an insider threat
conference. Here we are with the acronyms.
Oh, yeah. Welcome, everyone.
The Defense Strategies Institute.
And we are at their March conference in Monterey, California. And we are here with some of our incredible guests. We've got quite a few episodes planned for this week that we're going to record while we're out here, because we've got some of the best and brightest minds in the insider threat world. And we're going to take advantage of that. We're going to record a couple of episodes while we're out here this week.
Whether they want to or not, they're going to be hijacked into a room with us and these speakers and microphones and like, sit down and have a conversation. Let's just have a talk.
We've had some very, very kind people agree to spend some time with Pete and I out here working on this today. And in fact, we've got our very first guest here with us, Dr. Deanna Caputo. Dr. Caputo is the MITRE Corporation's chief scientist for insider threat capabilities and a senior principal behavioral psychologist. We're going to talk a little bit about what exactly that means. Dr. Caputo is an internationally recognized expert in insider threat and has 25 years of experience designing, conducting, and analyzing research with human participants using experimental, quantitative, and qualitative analyses. So we are excited. I, for one, am very excited to talk with Deanna about behavioral science research, something near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'm totally excited, too. I mean, and we were talking to Deanna before this. Kristen's a smart one here.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, and
he
gives
me a run for my money.
And I'm just the Swiss Army knife guy.
thank God, because we need you to do things like, you know, figure out the cord for the recording.
I got a new nickname, Swiss Army
Swiss
Knife.
Swiss Army
and
Knife.
I think actually you gave me that nickname. So thank you, Deanna.
You're welcome. You're showing many skills.
Many skills.
You didn't know when you were coming on today that you would be giving out nicknames as well, but
it was in the hallway even before I got here, but it carried. See, it stuck. That's a good nickname.
It
is. It sticks. It's good.
That's exactly right. Well, we are so excited to talk to you about your work, but I think really we've always tried on this podcast to start by really getting to know the person behind the work.
Sure.
And so, you know, I did a little introduction. I know you've been with MITRE for a long time. We want to talk about your role there.
You say I'm old?
No, ma'am. I think you and I graduated from college the same year, actually.
Oh, that's
so
true.
I think you're just the perfect age.
It keeps
getting better.
You're
as
not
far.
Biased at all.
Maybe only slightly. But I also have spent many years doing behavioral science research in the area of insider threat. So I'm so excited to talk to you about this work. But I also realize it's not the most obvious, clear trajectory to, you know, my guess is you didn't, when you were 15, probably have all of this mapped out ahead of you.
Correct.
I'm guessing it took some surprising twists and turns along the way.
True.
Tell us a little bit about how you got to this work. How on earth did you end up working in insider threat?
Sure. My trajectory started, I have wanted to be a clinical psychologist, which I am not, since I was 10. And so I had that trajectory pretty planned out. And then my last year in college, I had this epiphany of, I don't want to do therapy. It was a really big deal. And I'd planned out colleges and done all my applications. And so then it's the what are you going to do with your life concept. And that's almost harder when you thought you knew what you wanted to do. And so I kind of thought back to all the classes I had taken in psychology. So I still wanted to be a psychologist. But my affinity was more towards the social influence and social psychology. And those were the courses where I could help the greater population of people if I moved outside of clinical issues and talked about like everyday people problems and worked towards solutions for those problems. And so I pivoted at the last minute and I still got into grad school, shockingly. So I'm a straight-througher all through college straight to graduate school, and ended up working with some fantastic social psychologists. And so my credentials is social and personality psychology. But I started with one advisor who did, Tom Gilovich, some amazing things in social influence, which is what I wanted to do. And then I met Dave Dunning, and Dr. Dunning did things that were more practical, like police lineups and eyewitness IDs. And I was lured to the practicality of those things, right? Not understanding something just to understand it, but understanding it so that we could change something about how we're doing things and make the world a better place. I know that sounds kitsch, but that was sort of the lure to more applied research, which kind of meant leaving academia, because academia doesn't they do more now, but back then I would say it was really unusual to do that applied work. And Dave Dunning did both that and other classic social psychology. So I'd have to do that and to stay in that world. And so my dissertation was all on eyewitnesses and police lineups, and I loved it all. And I thought I was going to come out and I was going to help police departments do better lineups. And then I talked to police departments, and they said, oh, yeah, that's really interesting, but you'd have to become a police officer. And I was like, I didn't go through all this schooling and stay poor until I was 26 years old then go to the police academy, right?
Right, right.
And so it was one of those sort of decisions then, but I was already had an affinity for, like, law enforcement, but helping, right? This is not about judging. Yeah. They have a really tough job on the behavioral side, and I think that there's a lot of value from behavioral scientists looking at how they do what they do and just making it stronger. And so when that option, I was jury and trial consulting. I did that for a whole year.
Yep. Mm.
That is a totally different thing. And I did this huge murder trial in Ithaca, where I was a grad student upstate New York. So I was still...
That's right. You were at Cornell.
I was, yes. And that was the only grad school I got in. So that's always a good harken to, you plan this whole path and then you applied all these schools. And I only got into the long shot one. So Cornell was my long shot school. It's amazing.
Deanna, it's really strange. That was my experience as well. That's why I got to go to Duke. They were the only ones who wanted me.
Right. And you're like, okay, well, this is a meant-to-be concept.
Yep. I mean, especially for graduate school, it's really about the match, the personality to the program. Because they are really very different.
They are. And I was waitlisted too, so I didn't even automatically get in. So you probably got in right away. I was even waitlisted. But then when you interview with them, that's when they see your match, right? So then I had an interview and the sync.
And it sounds like you found your place there.
Correct, exactly. But they give you an opportunity to find your place, which I like, which means I started with one advisor and I was able to move without drama or issues and do what I was enjoying the most, right? Which was experiments with students and things like that. And so it was a fabulous experience, but I learned a lot and thought I was going to take it to the real world. And then the world starts, and we know that the world is different than what you often expect it to be. But lots of goodness. And then I got recruited by the intelligence community at a conference. And so that's actually how I got to D.C.
Oh, interesting.
So I was doing the jury and trial consulting, which was fascinating, but I was waiting for the processing and clearances.
Yes.
And then the HR department at DIA was frozen. And so I was like, well, I can't wait much longer. So I ended up as a contractor, which is also a different experience than I expected.
Yeah.
We can attest.
I bet you can attest to that. Yes. And so I did profiles of foreign leaders for the military, like sort of information operations.
Oh,
and
wow.
Sign-ups. That must have been fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's also very introverted because you're looking at a lot of intel on a computer the entire time.
Yeah.
So it's like a cube life.
For a person who is a social psychologist and I can imagine, knowing you and knowing your personality, you are a people person.
I am an extrovert through and through. And so
without a doubt.
Almost 3 years, I was like, I don't think this is the job for me.
But you didn't want to be a clinician, right?
Yeah, that wasn't less about engaging with people. I really do enjoy that. I think, but clinical psychologists only help so many people that sit in front of them.
Yes.
And not because of whether they're good at it or not, because that's just how the human works, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to come in and some it's going to work and you're going to be helpful. The number I was given was 30%.
Yeah.
So you help about 30% of people that walk through. And I just, that number didn't work for me. I was like, that is just too small for the amount of effort and compartmentalizing, because you're dealing with people's issues. And I just decided that wasn't the right fit. And obviously things happen for a reason.
And she also didn't want to be doing push-ups in the gravel with Dr. Carrie Gibson.
Hey,
listen.
You haven't lived until you've done push-ups and flutter kicks and gravel dirt at places. But so there was, you went to this conference and there was like a help wanted desk, like a desk of recruiters that were there from the intelligence community.
I was at the American Psychology and Law Society conference.
Yes.
And I met two really renowned clinicians in the community. One said, you're not a clinician, we're not interested. Uh-huh. That was fascinating. Oh, here wow. I am. Yeah. And then the other said, come meet me in DC and let's talk about all the kinds of things that you could do, and was almost enamored in having and recognizing that social psychologists are different. I'm a research psychologist, yes. but the summary would be we measure attitudes, intentions, and behaviors, and then we try to change attitudes, intentions, and behaviors, which is very different than the kind of recruitment and the clinical approaches. And so it's just a different perspective that person thought would be an added value to the kind of work that they were doing in the intelligence community, which isn't exactly what I ended up doing, but it was a great way to learn enough to be willing to say yes. How do you take a job where they can't tell you exactly what you're going to do?
Yeah, that's got to be, that was not my career path. I mean, I kind of knew what an FBI agent did, right. So I thought,
yes.
But like there are jobs in the community, intelligence community, where you just don't know. And we'll tell you once you get in
correct
what we do, but what we do is classified. So we can't really tell you. That's hard. Look at that leap of faith you did.
It was intriguing though. So they went with the intrigue enough to say, what do I have to lose? Right. I was still young. And if it didn't work out, then I was
try something else.
I was in a city center, right? DC is a lot of jobs and areas. So
yeah.
I think it was an experiment of its own, right, coming down. And like I said, the 3 years worked out okay. It was really interesting. I learned a lot about intel and the military and a lot of things that helped me do what I do now.
Yeah.
But I also learned that sitting in front of a cube looking information as a social and actually, most social psychologists aren't very social, just so you know. I find it's really true. I'm the worst representative of that because I am, but a lot of them are not. And
ironically,
like, you're a social psychologist, but you're not very social. but I am, and so I wanted something that was more engaging. And so I went on the job market, which is interesting when you have a clearance. It does matter, and it's interesting.
Yeah,
so I went to a job fair by the Washington Post.
Huh.
And it was mostly engineering companies. DHS was brand new, and so they were hiring. But so I dropped my resume at a bunch of places, and I found MITRE because I had just perused past three stands that said, oh, yeah, you're not an engineer. And so when I got to the end one, which was MITRE, I said, oh, I'm not an engineer. And the guy's like, well, what are you then? And I said, I'm a psychologist. And he's like, ooh, we have a department of people just like you. It was the strangest entree to kind of a new area. But I was hired in 2 weeks. It was probably really fast for a hire, but I had the right tickets, right?
You had your clearance already.
That was all taken care of. And so it was a great opportunity. And then it'll be 19 years in August. It makes me feel old saying that out loud. But every year is a little different because I get different problems. Seasoned. We're experienced.
Yep.
We give it fancy titles, but really you are. And I do think that experience makes everything I do from then on just better and better. I get better at it. And it's been great.
So I have a question about MITRE. MITRE is an FFRDC, but what does that, right? No, I'm wrong. See?
The government funds FFRDCs, federally funded research and development centers, but MITRE operates FFRDCs. So we are selected and you compete to operate, and MITRE operates 6 FFRDCs, which is a lot. And that's the only thing MITRE does. That's probably different than some of the other FFRDC operators that do that and other things. MITRE only operates FFRDC. Wow. So it's a not-for-profit as well, which is, I do think, a really important part.
Yeah.
I tell people when they interview, like what I like is that I get to tell the government what they need to hear. Uh-huh. It may not be what they want to hear, but because the for-profit means that I can tell them even if they're not happy about it, they can fire you in the same sense of, I guess they could pick a different FFRDC operator, but it's not the same for-profit as, you know, one of the for-profit companies and you're telling the government they take the contract away. Like the consequence is greater, right, for our DIB than the way MITRE is situated. But it's a nice, sweet spot.
Well, and as a researcher, that's actually really important, right? I mean, I think people, our listeners may not, if they're not in this world doing this work, may not understand the implications of that.
Correct.
I mean, to have the freedom to really speak the truth of your research findings is incredibly important. Good research only goes so far if you can't accurately share what you have
It's
learned.
A privilege. I think it was a privilege, and I'm grateful for that. So we get paid better than government, but not as good as the dib across the street. So there's a, you know, everyone chooses what they value most. We value the mission. And so there's, you know, a salary hit for that, too. But it's worth it to do exactly what you said, which is you get to work more and ensure that you have impact from the things that you do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm super proud of that. And I've built a great team of behavioral scientists and miners, systems engineering. So, you know, we're carving out and bringing other, you know, multidisciplinary areas. And so I've hired teams of behavioral scientists, and it's bringing them to this problem space is super valuable, pulling them out of academia or wooing them to not go into academia, because we need different perspectives out here too.
Well, and you said one of my favorite words, multidisciplinary.
Yes.
My goodness, that's so important. I mean, Pete and I have radically different backgrounds, but we work on a team and we work cases together, right?
Right.
And the way our team works, we have at least 5 different people working each case, each with a different background.
Right.
You've been on the side of trying to build a team,
right?
Trying to figure out who are those essential components. Who are some of the people you brought into, the types of people you brought into your interdisciplinary team?
So we still have to work with a lot with the engineers that are at MITRE. So we have lots of engineers, data scientists, and cyber scientists. So the first team I built was a human behavior and cybersecurity capability. That was the first capability I built for MITRE, which is bringing those behavioral scientists to the table with the data and cyber scientists to make the things that we were learning about cyber better and usable, like usable security. So it's not usability like GUI, you know, what things look like. It's how the user is going to interact. And I heard a speaker here say something like, our software engineers, like they do all the red team testing, but they aren't the user. And so those are the models that we had to counter even in the government, which is those aren't the people that should be looking to see if what you've built is useful and helpful to the person using it in Intel. We build a lot of things for the military and for intelligence, but who's going to make sure that they're impactful, and who's going to understand the human side of that, like what they bring and why people do what they do and how. That's outside of that realm. Yeah. And so I had to educate though the difference between multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Have you bumped into that?
Yeah.
Which is, I'll just go learn about what you do.
Yep.
And then it's interdisciplinary.
Yep.
And I think
it doesn't quite work that way.
It is not. And I've also tried to train engineers to have a more behavioral perspective.
Yeah.
Or I have to train behavioral scientists to have a very applied law enforcement security perspective. And I would say training the behavioral scientist is easier than the other way.
Probably.
Like engineers are super brilliant and they're wedded, but it's like, it's the unicorn that's really good at the human stuff, to be honest, right? The image of them walking at their feet, like that's kind of true. But they're so brilliant, but the multidisciplinary is the magic, which is we come together.
Yep.
You bring what you know, I bring what I know, a fourth, fifth, however many you need. And we talk about it and we come to something. That is the magic. The interdisciplinary, if I'm going to go learn enough to apply and bring a little human, that isn't as effective.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize there's a difference.
Yeah. And you've got to have those people. I mean, depending on the situation, if we're working a case, you know, sometimes you need external resources as well. But just having those core components of those people that have different perspectives and are bringing, you know, for example, bringing a scientific methodology, a perspective of let's bring some science to bear on this question. I mean, that's not a perspective that every single team member is going to bring, but it's a pretty important one, isn't it?
Yeah, and it comes up a lot of discussion at the Insider Risk Summit that we're at about AI.
Yes.
And what are we going to do with the AI agents that are now like employees, right? And they're taking on roles. But what I'm not hearing is like, what do those AI agents look more like the humans on the inside? Do they look more like an APT who came from the outside and is now inside? Because a human insider looks different from an APT that got in.
Yeah.
I already know that. I've demonstrated that. But we're making assumptions now about what that AI agent's going to look like. And what we really need to do is go figure that out and go study it, right? And figure out what they look more like so we can borrow the right indicators instead of just leveraging what we have and hoping it will stick. And so that's the research perspective. What's the piece we still need to research? And then there's pieces that don't need research, of course.
Well, and speaking of indicators, you've done an awful lot of research on the area of psychological indicators, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so you're right, we're talking about, if we're talking about AI, we're talking about a really different sort of application that's very different than the human individual that we're used to thinking
Correct.
Of as the center of an insider risk.
Yeah, I think the humans have helped us out a little bit. Unlike violence mm-hmm. and violence threat assessment, which I think is kind of a different kind of
adjacent
person.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other kinds of insider risk are more similar in the sense that the humans, we're looking for the behaviors that they do. The why they do it has been less valuable for indicators. So you said
yes.
indicators, you didn't say interesting or
nope.
deterrence.
Yep.
We're looking at deterrence, and then the why you do it matters. But when I'm looking at indicators, what we have learned from the research is whether I'm doing it because of money mm-hmm. or ideology doesn't seem to change how
right.
I do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And what we're going to detect
yep.
is the how.
Right.
So I actually don't have to worry about, for detections and indicators, mm-hmm. why you're doing it.
Yep.
I get to worry about what you do and what you do that shows me that there's a risk there or that you're a potential risk, of course, because this is, you know, people are not clear. It's not obvious, right? And same
yeah.
with that. And that's probably similar to the violence.
Yep.
But otherwise, though, the type and whether you're doing unauthorized disclosure, which is taking stuff that's not yours, or sabotaging something, that doesn't seem to look a lot different until we get to the behaviors.
Right, right. It's interesting we talk about AI because it. First of all, I'm scared to death of it.
You should be probably.
Terrified of it, and we have a conversation. The next conversation we have is with some technical folks that have a lot of background on this, and I wonder from the clinical perspective if Kristen, you've had an experience where seeing patients. They've run to put in their symptoms in AI, some AI, and spit out some kind of diagnosis.
Oh, yeah.
That you all would be doing as psychologists.
Yeah.
But that the computer's doing, and you're like, yeah, that's
well,
not quite.
Do you remember when WebMD
yeah.
first became a thing and people could
yes.
start looking up their own symptoms?
Right.
The number of patients who
misdiagnosed.
Began self-diagnosing
yeah.
things was just really exponential. And yeah, I think AI is just going to increase that as well.
I'm confident that AI is not going to take away the jobs of psychologists and psychiatrists.
Nah.
I am worried about threat managers and investigators, but I think you all are safe.
I would recommend not using AI as your therapist. I mean, there's some really good reasons not to.
There's some really good research showing the negative consequences, especially
yep.
for young people.
Yeah.
Where it recommends things or supports something that you're planning to do.
Yes.
Like suicidality and things, and just says, yeah, maybe you should do that.
Yeah.
It actually says that.
Yep.
Really? That's really what we want our youth, especially, to be talking to.
It's designed to be encouraging, right?
Yeah.
Which is really wonderful in certain situations. And
right.
in other situations, it has really dire consequences, suicidality
Correct.
Being a great example.
But we haven't done this in a structured research way, but we have gone to the AI and said, like, how would you be a spy? Tell
yeah.
me what you would do. It's not that smart, if that helps you out. So I don't think we're going to have more insiders
Good.
Because they go
That's
to AI
right.
and say, tell me how to be bad.
Yep.
I do think if they're more specific, like
yeah.
how do I go do this specific activity on my
yeah.
computer, that they're going to get some help. But
yep.
I think a lot of that help has already been out there if they wanted to do it. If you wanted to use encrypted email, you can go learn how to do that. So I think those obfuscation, even on cyber and stuff, they could get. It might just be more sophisticated now.
Well, I think about, you know, the case studies of the notable spies that are become public because of an arrest. You'll get the stories told of this person, that person. Others that may want to follow down that road or are following down that road could learn some. Well, I'm like Ames. I'm not going to go buy and replace all of my drapes in my entire house and tell my friend who works at the CIA that I'm doing that way beyond my affordability. So you're going to be able to learn things from the public disclosure of cases, but I don't think that's fundamentally an issue, frankly. And AI, you know, none of us really know. We don't really know what, you know, AI is not the future, it's the present.
Yeah.
And
true.
We don't really know where we're going with this Maybe I'll need some psychological help after this. I could use some therapy after this AI conversation.
I'll take a walk.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
You have designed an experiment. So we do lots of different experiments to build cyber user activity monitoring indicators. And maybe some of your coming attendees will reference stuff like that.
Yep.
But there are experiments to figure out how an insider would use AI to be more evasive in order to get around current detectors and indicators. And so we'll see who wants to fund that, but we have already built sort of a proposal around what we need to learn, and we need to learn with real humans. So this isn't the AI agent being the employee, but other human employees deciding they want to be an insider and them getting advice on how to do it or just using AI to execute some of the behaviors. We don't know how they're going to do that. And we also don't know that we wouldn't see it or how we would see it. And so that's where the experiments with real employees in the real work environments is the benefit. We kind of skip the why it's interesting and get right to the if we're going to do it with the AI, we'll have different groups do the same task, and one group will use AI, one group won't use AI, and we'll look for legitimate differences between those groups, and that's where science comes in, and we can use the experimental method.
And that's where MITRE would come in, and maybe we'll do
that. That is the kind of experiment we would do. And we have done those for other cyber indicators, but that's exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, when you change your intent as a human, your behavior naturally changes. So that was one of the first things I got to kind of show case about psychology, non-clinical, was that you can learn things. I can have you do one thing with your intent is bad and someone else do the same thing with a different intent. And actually how they do it on a computer is different. And so we're leveraging that to differentiate risk factors from different employees. They're not, you haven't done anything bad, but that's the proactive, when you hear that proactive risk. Yeah. It's supposed to be risk factors, not I've done something bad factors. That's a threat. They've already posed that threat.
It's and already happened.
Yeah. And so we have some of those designed for AI. We just have to get the funding to execute them. But I think that's how we're going to learn the most and stop guessing. We're going to be actually really able to see how employees do that and watch them. Again, employees never get in trouble for any of these kind of experiments. We're really good at that part, which is really important, is that you use employees for experiments. And I don't mean use and abuse. I mean, you have them do their jobs and you protect them from any consequences from that, right? We're here to learn. And that is the important part.
I think it's interesting that when we talk about the use case studies, the big, the Hansons and the Ameses of the world. And I think once they're identified as prime suspects, that investigation part is not all that hard. It's the gray area, the in-between, this concerning behavior that could be this, could be that, it could be nothing. That's where I think, you know, we deal with a lot of the gray area. You probably deal a lot of the gray area in your work at MITRE.
Absolutely.
That's where I think it's a really, really tough. Once someone's crossed that line, now catching them in the act of committing espionage or putting the case together, and I'm have some personal experience on this, so I can say this with some background, that's not as hard as looking at an individual who's exhibiting some concerning behaviors.
Right.
These potential risk indicators that you talk about, but not enough where they've crossed that line. And how do we deal with those medium-sized cases, if you will, as individuals? Well,
that's what makes this so much fun.
That's right.
That's the hard part, but it is the intriguing part that keeps us going, right?
This is much more fun than trial jury kind of work.
Exactly. It might be more fun than some of your investigative work, but like you said, it's an important part, but you're pulling strings that you're already aware of a lot of, and we're grasping at straws.
So one of the things that we've been talking about, psychological indicators, is fascinating and really challenging, I think, because there are so many different types of insider threat, right? There are so many different risks. There's so many different potential problematic behaviors. The risk indicators for those, there may be some overlap, right? But there's going to be different indicators for different types of problems that people might have, I would imagine.
Correct. And I think that the research takes away from the chasing the last bad guy approach. I mean, that's essentially how I got here. I failed my first MITRE task, truly. I was supposed to build indicators about a past case. But what I realized is that they were asking me to build indicators, and those are going to create a lot of false positives. So this is where we get into a little bit of the geekiness of each indicator alone has a false positive rate where you're wrong. Because these are risk. They're not obvious they haven't done the bad thing. But when you have a lot of single ones, what we really need are sets of indicators. When
yes.
the employee does A, B, and F in a short window of time,
yeah.
our risk is higher and we're yeah. more concerned because that lowers the false positive rate of doing it one by one by one.
Great but point.
That isn't how we started. That's not how this approach was. It was a very law enforcement approach
mm-hmm.
Without the expertise of knowing that the humans, we can learn from them without having known bad. Like, we don't have to wait until we have 100 cases to learn things. We can do some of those experiments that I mentioned to see how your behavior changes with your intent or why, with your use of a different tool. How do you do things differently? So I think psychology brings a lot to insider threat, both the clinical, but I also think it brings a lot of that non-clinical to get better PRIs, potential risk indicators. And that word potential is important because they're proactive. They're yeah. before something bad has happened, yep. right? Everyone, left of boom, like you hear all yeah, the different versions.
Yeah. We got a box full of cliches.
We do.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. What we really want to do is manage risk, right? Yep. It's
yeah.
still risk management. And so our goal is to figure out, I mean, you have insider threat programs, and that's a lot of the people that are here mm-hmm. at the Insider Symposium and the summit. But the goal is to figure out what they should be looking at every day.
You're right.
Where should they focus their attention? And that's not the easiest task. I think they have a really hard task, and we have a lot to learn still to help them, but we're at it. We're excited about it.
Well, you mentioned that the why doesn't matter so much for understanding those or recognizing those indicators. Where it begins to matter more is the mitigation, right? And
yes.
the why can be radically different for people. You gave a talk this morning, and one of the things that I was really fascinated by, you mentioned loneliness.
Mm.
Loneliness
mm.
as
yes.
a potential motivator for some of these types of insider threats. Not probably what people think of. First off, especially if we're talking unauthorized disclosure, espionage,
right.
people probably think financial motivation, right?
Right. Why would you leak information when you're lonely?
Right.
But it just doesn't
exactly.
seem intuitive, but it is.
It certainly can be. And there's a real, really significant portion of the population that struggles with this. I mean, post-COVID particularly, I mean, I think people have consistently reported feeling more disconnected from each other and from other people. And we know that's a fundamental human need.
Right.
But what kind of an impact could something like that have in insider risk?
But if we detected only loneliness, we'd have a whole lot of false
right.
positives.
Exactly.
Right? If you detected loneliness by itself,
yep.
you would be overpopulated, right?
Yeah.
You might have a couple of those lonely people that might do the wrong thing. And you're going to have the rest of the lonely people that would never do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And so that is a good example of where you need a set. You need something around it
yeah.
besides it by itself
yeah.
That you need to correlate as that risk factor. Otherwise, or I guess it would have to be certain types of loneliness if that was even possible. Or I think a good example of something we explored was organizational loyalty. So we had a lot of insider risk programs ask, because I'm the behavioral scientist, I want to know org commitment. I want you to build me an indicator that tells me if my employees are committed to me for my program.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're diving into the science, and we're looking at past espionage cases and other research we've done. And what we see is it's two-way. And so we've redefined that. And we're going to be putting out a paper, like a peer-reviewed publication, just so that people can get that concept. But it's bi-directional loyalty. What you need to know is how loyal is that person to your company or the government. But what you also need to know is how loyal they perceive the organization is to them.
To them, yeah.
Because our past spies, particularly, are very clear
yeah.
that they didn't think their organizations were loyal to them anymore.
Yeah.
And then in the science, they had this like third piece, which I think actually will resonate really well, both with the psychologist and investigator, was like, people don't like to feel stuck.
Mm.
Right. And so,
right,
like they don't have a choice in their environment. That stuck feeling makes them make poor choices. It leads to, young people who can't get out of their situation just deciding to go bad and be bad. But in this environment, stuck doesn't have to be because of the organization, though. You could be stuck because your spouse can't move, right? It doesn't mean that the org has caused it. But when you have low loyalty, where I don't feel so loyal, I don't think they're as loyal to me, and I'm kind of stuck here. That is a recipe for disaster, or it's a recipe for risk, to be honest. So
yeah.
that's not to be dramatic, but we can measure that. And so we've been working on measures of bidirectional loyalty, but not as a detector. So that's the interesting part. Uh-oh. So it's actually the opposite of what everyone would expect from us, but as a deterrent. Because mm-hmm. you can do a better job of like heat mapping low bidirectional loyalty and then just boosting it. So it'll be really fun to put out something that says, don't detect someone not doing good. Detect that it's off and go do something about it. Like go boost that.
Act.
Go show them that you're loyal to them. And there are easy ways to do that for orgs. And so that'll be kind of a different approach than our normal detectors, which are negative risks. Right?
That's a positive message, right? I mean, that's just, there's, you know, there's an action you can take that moves this person back on a positive pathway versus a negative pathway.
Yeah, and it's hard to do individually. It's better collectively.
True.
And so it'd be more like managers could either help report that, or you can do self-report, which came up, for example, today with climate surveys. One of the speakers brought up, like, that they get climate survey data. I would argue that most people in that room that weren't inside our programs never have access to climate survey data, but they should.
Yeah.
And these bidirectional loyalty questions could be on that climate survey, and you would get it back anonymized, non-attribution, mm-hmm. but you would see probably pockets that are high or low, less than individuals. And there's some goodness in that, and that makes HR more comfortable working with security people when we're not always looking at individuals yet, right? Well, we're focused on sort of collective, happy, unhappy, high loyalty, low, and we're doing things that are more the group. It does make them like the programs better and feel like we're not targeting people.
Well, it's a different way of conceptualizing risk too, and understanding where that risk is coming from. It's not just sitting within the individual coming into the organization and then it leaves when that person leaves, right?
Exactly.
There's some very real important things in interactions between the individuals and the organization itself.
And the environment you put them in. It could be as easy as where they're working in the building and it has sort of issues, right? The HVAC's always off. That collective group can deteriorate as a group, or we get asked about toxic leaders a lot, which I do think some of that is a bit more clinical, and I'm not a clinician, so we don't diagnose leaders in any way, but I do think toxic leaders is like a lot of little things.
Yeah. Environmental.
Correct. Yeah. And so these are the pieces of that. We're not going to have a measure for toxic leader. We're going to have a measure of that environment. Something's not right. Yeah.
But to that point, do you think like Ames, Hansen, all the Snowden, all of the classic poster people for espionage, if they had a positive work environment and they felt it, would they? Do you think they would not have committed espionage, or would it have mattered?
I don't think it would have mattered based on the
for those folks. They were committed.
Ones.
Yeah,
but we're taking a slice out. It's kind of like the Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
Like we're building something for one group, but I do not think any of these are going to block all types, right? But the ones you mentioned, I don't think this would have made a difference. But for others, it would.
That could be contemplating and maybe going down that pathway and thinking about, but the folks that are really hardcore, no, I'm going to commit espionage and unauthorized disclosure because of this reason, no matter how well I'm treated.
This probably affects recruitment as well. So I think these individuals, it wouldn't, yes, I don't think it would have changed the hardcore one, the particular ones that you mentioned, but it does make them people easier to recruit as well. So these sort of softer things or leadership and loyalty.
Yeah, don't take me wrong. Like I don't mean to say, well, this is junk because we can't predict, you know, I'm just kind of putting in perspective of wondering if it would have prevented them, but it's still important. It can help the majority of the workforce. I mean, it help our cultures that we create at our own work environments, I think.
No, I think you're pointing out a really important thing, which is there's no panacea. There's no silver bullet for all of them. So I didn't read that as bad at all. I think it was a great question. And the ones you gave, I'm like, nope. But other ones, yes. But that's the answer, right? There's not going to be one set of indicators that stops them all. Mm-hmm. And so we have to say that out loud. Like, we have to continue to build a variety of options in those layers and hope we get lucky, right? And that we blocked one thing that was the reason or the opportunity to recruit that. So I agree with you. I think some people are defensive that way. Like, you don't like my one idea, but it's not going to fix everybody. So we have to think of the different types.
Yeah. I get one great question per podcast, and that's pretty much it. That was my one.
I'm sure there's many.
So, but it, you're right. It comes back to that heterogeneity, right? You don't, correct. I mean, some insiders come in with the intent to cause harm. Some come in with really good intentions of being a great employee and something happens along the way. We have unintentional insiders who are careless or sloppy, right? And so all of these different motivations are going to have different indicators, different things that we're going to see ahead of time, and different potential strategies for trying to intercept that person.
Yeah, that's what makes this a hard problem, which keeps it interesting, but that's what makes it difficult, is that we're not going to find the thing and it's done. We're going to find the thing that helps this one category of insiders, and we're going to take that, and then we'll move forward and hope for more. But it's not going to be solved.
Well, behind the keyboard is a human being.
Right.
And that human being, I mean, that's insider threat, to encapsulate it, there's a human being behind that computer that has stressors and predispositions and all these different things, grievances that are maladaptive, all these things are impacting that person behind the keyboard that's going to do something good or bad. And that's why we're never going to be out of a job, I think.
No, and there's also no profile. So no. I'll be the first to say that there's clinical profiles and then there's other profiles.
Sure. Yeah.
There's no profile for this. If it was that, it'd be nice. That would be very nice. But it's
wouldn't that be easy?
It would be.
It'd simple.
It'd be easier even.
Yeah.
But it's just not there. Or we're all really not smart. And I find that the number of people in that room right now, there's a lot of smart people in there and new profiles coming out. So we're just going to have to remember that and hope and build right off the things that people are doing, but not assume it's going to fix it. No panacea here.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about that a little bit. You did a presentation earlier today, talked about some of your research. And one of the things that I've found most fascinating about it is that there isn't this profile that emerges. You know, we keep going back to the data. We have to, right? To say what is, you know, not just in a single case study, but what is the data? What are the patterns that we can see here? And I think just as important, what patterns don't we see?
I love it when I can talk about what we didn't see.
Right?
What people expect you to see. I'm like, there was nothing there.
Yeah, it turns out we've got people of all ages, all races. We've got different genders. We've got people.
Well, gender, I will say. They're mostly guys.
It's the one place where demographics hold up.
Can I tell you about that one woman who committed espionage?
I know, but that was the exception and not the norm.
It
was
like, what's it, 13%?
Correct.
Maybe it's very small. I know that in serial killers, I get it. I know.
But you're right. All the demographics, there's a lot of variability.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, though, in the future, what we're advocating for is that we are collecting and creating data sets now. And that's where we'll find patterns. There's still no profile.
Yeah.
I do think we can find better patterns.
Yes.
But you have to do it. You have to start it. And you have to keep doing it.
Yep.
That's how we're going to get ahead. And that's what we were talking about, is creating a data set where we're putting all that known bad data and letting it aggregate. But you got to be patient, which nobody's patient. Right?
No one is.
We don't have that anymore.
One of the answers in the 1 year version, but that's not where you're going to see the magic. And there is no magic, as we mean, but it won't reveal itself until you keep adding more data, and then you'll see stuff.
But you're right. It is about behavioral profiles, not about demographic profiles. It's not about looking at someone saying, I can see from looking at you, you fall into this group. It's more, you know, except for potentially the male issue.
Thanks.
Well, you speak on behalf of all men.
Thank you. But the behavioral profiles, that's a different thing.
Yeah, but it's kind of good. I think it's a good outcome that it's not on demographics. I think that's safer for companies.
Yeah.
I think it's safer for government and the employees in there.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was there, we would still make use of it. I think the fact that that hasn't shown promise or need is a good thing.
I think it actually
is, too. In the long run,
destigmatizes
security, right? Yeah. And it gives them the opportunity to show that they're looking at behaviors, right?
Yeah.
And that they're not profiling anyways, but also demographically profiling or by race or anything like that, because it just, there's no data to support that.
Right.
And that, I think that ends up in the good.
But, and also good news, there is a lot to support the idea that there are behavioral indicators, right?
Yes.
The behavior, the actual individual behavior is what it's all about, right?
Yes.
Understanding that the way that a person responds to an environment can tell you something about what's going on with them and about how they might respond to the next situation.
Yes, exactly. And so I think those are the behaviors that we're taking, creating good indicators. But then you have to detect them. And this is a challenge that people don't talk enough about.
Actually see them.
Yeah.
We'll actually be allowed to record whatever you're supposed to see, though. Yeah. So these programs are, you know, told, like, what if I can give you a good indicator, but what if it's not something easy for you to detect without talking to them?
Right.
Well, we don't talk to our employees. Security is supposed to be like this, from a distance.
Yep.
Non-touch kind of thing. And as it should be. But sometimes you have to talk to humans to learn things. So we're always trying to find observable measures of those behavioral things. And that is hard. So we do have some things where we have a good indicator, but we don't know how to see it without engaging an employee. And so those we'll just keep working at until we can find that. But that's okay. We're still closer than we were.
I'm wondering if you can think of any creative examples of that, of behaviors that might be maybe not the first and obvious thing. I mean, sometimes we think first of these sort of egregious behaviors, right? And we certainly have those.
Yeah.
You know, everyone who logs onto a government computer gets a reminder that their communications are being monitored, and you know what you're doing on this computer is not anonymous, right? Can be tracked back to you. And yet still, we nonetheless still have people make really terrible choices of things to do on their government computers that they should not be doing, right? Some of those are pretty easy to recognize and say, well, you know, this is obviously not okay to be doing this on your work computer or maybe anywhere. but you'd think it'd be especially obvious, you know, to not do it on your work computer.
Sure.
But most of the time, it's not that in your face. The behaviors, the kind of concerning behaviors that we're talking about are not always necessarily problematic in and of themselves.
They're not. Right? They're risk factors. Essentially risk factors. My favorite one is probably what we refer to as psychological financial strain. And so the indicator is how much you care about your debt. It's not about the debt itself.
Oh,
we have substantial data. We have piles of cases of people for very small amounts of money doing the wrong thing in industry and government. $1,000. $5,000. Like we sit back and be like, you would put your livelihood and your freedom at risk for $5,000. But there are people that having any debt makes you a bad person.
Right.
And we don't know the why they got that way, but there's a lot of people that fret over any debt level. And then we all know people have a lot of debt and they just don't care. And not in a bad way. They pay their minimums, but that concept of having a large amount of debt or even paying the interest on that, they don't care. They don't understand finances and interest. Either way, they're not stressed enough that you'd be able to recruit them or that they would decide to put their livelihood at risk. And so when you take both of those into account, it isn't the debt number.
Yep.
It's not the type of debt. We've seen no pattern in the type or amount of debt.
Yep.
What we see is people so stressed out about that debt. And so how do you measure that? Well, you talk to people, which is not going to be very helpful for an insider threat program. So we're working on observable measures of strain, both on a computer and interpersonally. And so we have some hypotheses, but we haven't been able to test them yet. But that would be an example where we have the indicator. It is financial strain. I'm confident in that. I have the data to support that. What I don't have is the detector to hand that room full of people that are trying to do this for their organization. And so this is where we have to keep doing research.
But it's more the impact of the strain on the individual and how they feel about that.
I know that feeling.
And then the feeling. And then the investigators have to sit there and go, because we see these in our cases where there's a $1,000 kind of credit debt thing, and you know, if you're making good money, you're like, that's $1,000, it's not a big deal. But for that person, that $1,000 could be a million.
Yes.
I never thought of it from that perspective. And that makes total sense. And then we have an opportunity to like put our bias in there about our own views on debt. So wow. Okay.
Yeah, people worry. There are people who are like looking up their checking account balances constantly.
Yeah.
So that would be a potential cyber one, for example. Yeah. Like, I don't even need to see what you see. All I need to know is you go to your bank account and check it every day. There are people who check it every day. Mm-hmm. That's crazy in my mind that you would feel.
Okay, so I do that. All right. I do it in the morning and I have my spreadsheet and I make sure that it's.
Do you really?
I do. But it's just.
It makes you feel better.
It makes me feel better. It's not like I stress about it, but I just want to make sure.
But do you stress if you don't do that every day?
I can say I do. Yeah. I can honestly say I do. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like my spreadsheet doesn't match my checking account. I need to make sure. But I feel like it's me being more diligent and adult versus something that I need to speak to a professional about.
Or maybe it's, oh, well, are you worried about fraud and it not connecting?
No.
It just
not
makes
really.
You feel more secure.
It's just like kind of, I got my shirts dry cleaned and ironed and I make sure my bank account's up to date. Like it just makes me feel, puts me at ease.
Financial housekeeping.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's
it's like making your bed
example.
Every morning. I make my bed in the morning and then I check my, you know, it's just a basic part of my routine, my daily routine.
So those would be the false positives that we have to weed out. When I say like every behavioral indicator comes up with, we have a false positive.
I have a new nickname.
You would be the false positive because false you positive. Would still flag, yeah. But we would be like, you aren't really concerned the way you're not strained by it. It just is part of your process. And as long, but it's not the same kind of strain as other people that I'm talking about. Check. Right. They check to make sure that they, you know, it's not gone up or down, but they're more paranoid. So when we go look at strain, we're going to see what you describe. Then we have to figure out how to take and narrow it further. And so it's never going to be easy.
Now the difference between my checking account and my portfolio.
Yeah, I would say investments are different.
Investments are a totally different category. Yeah, we're not even going to have that conversation. Don't check your portfolio. Just kind of like do something else. Get a hobby. Go for a run. Something.
Well, but the underlying issue is it comes back to what does it mean to you?
Yeah.
Right? It's always about, you know, and I work with a patient, I always, this is something we focus on a lot, right? Because human experience isn't just what happens. It's the story we tell ourselves about what has happened to make sense of our own experience.
Correct.
And if you can understand a person's story, right? The story that helps them make sense of their world, now you're getting somewhere.
Yeah, I call that the clinical advantage, right? Like if you could sit down and talk to them about all these things, you'd be able to figure out which employees to worry about. We just don't do that. And that wouldn't be socially acceptable, and nor would I recommend that. But you would, I think you could do that. And now we have a security person who's not a clinician or even a psychologist has to go figure out how to do pieces of that appropriately.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the hard part. And we don't want to be asking them to do things they're not qualified to do, nor should be doing. And that's where people get the creepy factor of insider threat. We're always balancing the creepy factor.
Yeah.
And HR people that have also really good contextual data don't share because they're worried about the creepy factor of security people. And so I think doing the research is another way to give the program something to point to to reduce the creepy factor as they go to talk to other stakeholders.
Frontline managers.
And this is why I'm looking at this instead of, well, I'm looking at it because I want to.
Right.
No, I'm looking at this because research says that our insiders are more likely, not a profile, more likely to do X or Y. Yeah. And so we're going to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
And then we're, you know, you go and there's no consequence. There's no negative outcome. But pointing to research does make the other people in an organization more comfortable. And I think that's fair.
We at BTAC are very good and very appreciative of the research and point to research all the time, whether it's our bulletins. I mean, this whole podcast concept is about diving into the research that goes into the things that we write in these bulletins. So we're big fans of the research. So keep it up. Keep going.
Violence research is the hardest.
It is.
I remember I met Reed Malloy. I've only met him once at FBI event. And he saw the slammer research that I had done, which we can't talk about too publicly. But he came up and said, you do real research on insider threat. I'm like, what do you do? I can expose people, right, to money. I can expose you to, I can try to recruit you over LinkedIn and try to see how you respond and whether you report and how I can learn from the people that report to get everyone else to report without harm.
Yes.
You cannot expose people to violence in an experiment to see what they're going to do. So it's harder to study.
Not these days.
No. But we did do like a national survey on people's perceptions of like, we're trying to understand why employees tolerate a lot of escalation in the workplace. You would think that if somebody pushed me in the workplace, I'd report it. But people push people all the time and nobody reports it. I mean, if you put your hands on me in a workplace, so clearly I don't understand what people expect. So we wanted a bigger perspective. So we did do that, but it is so hard to get violence indicators, right? It definitely needs a more clinical flair. I do think there is a more clinical flair to that, but I also think that it's just harder. And so I don't envy that it's harder for us to even help you with research, but hopefully pieces of the research we do like adds value, right?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, one of the things we talked about a little bit earlier was a suicide study that you did, yes. right? There is, suicide is one of these really challenging domains to work within, whether as a clinician or as a researcher. It can yeah. have a lot of overlap with targeted violence. We know it's a risk factor for other forms of targeted violence. And of course, we're concerned about suicide just as an insider threat. If we're trying to protect our employees, our most important people, suicide is a very real risk right. To our most important asset, our people.
Right.
You've done some interesting research on suicide.
Opportunistic. So I take opportunistic all the time. Like if I see a data set that I think we could use, then I go hunt down funding. And so suicide, yes, I was working with a government agency and we were there building something else, like a different kind of research. And they were talking about suicide and they said something like, we've had like 30, 40K. I was like, you have that many cases of suicide, but this program also has full key logging data. Which and mm-hmm. I knew that part because I was using that kind of data for some of our other research. It's one of the best partners I've ever had was sharing their insider threat data so that we can quote research something new and really advance it as much as we can. You have to have good data and they have good data. And I said, if I could get funding, can I come back and use that data? And it turned out there were 45. We were able to, and there were probably more, but we were able to identify 45. And then they had like years of data back. Some were up from 3 to 8 years of data wow. where we could see patterns then. If you yeah. have 45 people, what can user activity monitoring data see, which is one data source for insider threat programs. And so we were able to, but unfortunately, as you know, because you saw the results, like there wasn't much.
Yeah.
And so I remember giving the news because I was very bummed to not have something valuable to give back to that program lead. And his response was like, you have to say that out loud. And I was, what are you talking about? And his answer was like, you need to tell people that this is not, I'm not the primary point person for this. Hmm. And that helps him
yep.
because they look at the insider threat programs and they just added suicide to their mission without even thinking about like, are you the best place?
Yeah.
But you have all this data, but that doesn't mean the data they have is the good data. The good
helpful.
Data is humans.
Yes.
Probably
yeah.
that I would have guessed, but I was hopeful we still find some cyber ones, right? Because it's automated, it's expedient to use cyber data, but there really wasn't. And sometimes that's how research works. But what we built was how they can help when an alert on that potential suicide comes quickly with the data they have. But we didn't produce great indicators for them, but we gave a better answer, which is you should not be the lead. Indicator,
yeah.
right? But you can be the support and here's things to help you.
Well, and that's the thing with research. We don't figure it all out at once. We do a study, we get a little piece of information, and then we create a mosaic with it, right?
Absolutely.
We do another study and we replicate or we don't. And then we begin to build a picture that helps us to understand a phenomenon.
Well, I think it's interesting from a non-researcher perspective. You look at what the BAU did originally with the serial killers, their original 33 study.
Yeah.
But they were the known knowns.
Yep.
They weren't the known unknowns, right? So, and then you had the Slammer where they interview all the different folks arrested for espionage. You are focusing on areas where it's a much greater pool in areas of unknowns, but like on a much more general basis that aren't specific with just the known knowns. It's a really interesting concept, and I definitely applaud you and what you're doing at MITRE in broadening that for the insider threat community. That's awesome.
We're trying and we're open to ideas. So I love these events because I talk to program leads and I say, like, what are you seeing right now? So I can figure out which ones we can study,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Not everything can be studied,
right.
but we want to take our shot at it and build those pieces. I love the mosaic. I'm not an artist. You must be an artist in some way because those are the people that think like that.
What a segue. What yeah. a segue into our...
It's a pretty good segue. Yes. I think Pete has a good question for you.
What do you do to unwind? What is your go-to hobby? Do you write? How do you get away from the day to day out and make you... What's your whole person treatment to get you to feel
sing.
Better?
You sing. I've been singing since I was 10.
This is a microphone.
You love surprises.
Tell
yeah.
us more. What kind of singing do you do?
Come on.
Yeah, I sing in a show choir. So a little dancing because I'm not a dancer. A lot of singing since I was little. Everywhere I've moved, I've always been in a choir. It's like my oasis. If you're a runner, you get it. It kind of takes your mind off of it. You can't sing and use your whole body and think of everything else just like a runner does. So it is the gift And you can sing anywhere.
You have to be fully present.
Can we find any of your recordings on YouTube or anything?
Probably not. No,
oh,
I just, yes, it's, but it's for me, but it's for others. I do solos and it's a great experience. So good question.
All right. We tried to get Deanna to sing. Come on, next time, Deanna, you're going to have to sing a little bit.
Maybe next time.
We'll do a duet.
If the two of you would do a duet, I would very much be here for
that.
We
need to practice. Yeah. We'll do some research on whether that can actually...
A little research, yes. A little practice. I love it.
Preparation.
Next time, Deanna, come back with a song for us.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. We've taken too much of your time already. We hope you enjoy the rest of the conference, and it was great to getting to know you better as a person, but also your research and all of your interesting things that you've done with MITRE and the job fair at the intelligence community way back when.
Well, and thank you for the work that you do. It's hard work. It's really important work. It informs the work that we do.
Yep.
And just on behalf of the community, thank you for it, because it's really, really incredibly important. It helps to move us all forward, I think.
Oh, well, thank you for having me and having interest in that and helping promote the research, and not for promotion's sake, but so that everybody listening realizes that we don't have it all, but what we do have, you should use, and then share what you need so that we can start doing the research that programs need if they think there's something specific, kind of like that org commitment turned into bidirectional loyalty. That all started with a comment, which is, I heard, you know, can you build something like that?
Yeah.
And then we can go look and see if that's a behavior that we can do more on. I mean, I do have the best team in the world, so I have to shout out to my behavioral scientists and data scientists back at MITRE that work insider threat. They've decided to only work insider threat, so I have a totally dedicated team of really smart people that are going to execute all this awesome stuff that we're doing. So I'm super proud and privileged, and so I want to thank them as well. But thank you for having me and being interested in it. It's less exciting than some of the investigations and things. I don't think it gets that kind of visibility, but we think it's exciting
and
as researchers.
Really important.
Yeah, we thank your team too, because I think they're going to be new podcast guest audience members. They're going to be fans now because if you're taking the time out to be on our show. So thank you so much.
I hope so. Well, I hope the rest of your exciting interviews go well, and I will return to listening to interesting people give talks.
Thank you, Dr. Caputo.
Have a great
Thanks,
day.
Thanks, Deanna. Well, that was episode 6 is done, and what a great guest Deanna was.
I knew it was going to be fun to talk to her. I am a little bit of a dork about behavioral science research. Nobody's quite as excited as I am about it, but hopefully maybe it's I kind of rub off a little. Maybe my enthusiasm rubs off on her audience.
You guys were having your thing, and it was really cool. It was nice to watch you both have that conversation, the PhD to PhD, and you know, injected a couple things in here. But it was a wonderful conversation. I was really that financial stress thing was really really interesting for me, not from a personal perspective, but from an investigator perspective. I thought that's something that our audience would generally learn from and benefit from. So there's a nugget there free of charge.
Yeah. She had a lot of really unique insights. I think the perspective of the researcher is one.
Yeah.
I mean, we have that a little bit with Carrie. Carrie does a lot of research, but she is a clinician, so she's coming from that different angle.
Carrie Gibson from the BAU. Yep.
So this is really a different kind of an angle on insider threat research than we've had before. So I'm excited to share that with our audience.
And MITRE's a big name in the insider threat space. Mm-hmm. And the research is well cited throughout. So real quick, we want to give a shout out and a thank you to the Defense Strategies Institute, DSI, for hosting us here. They have been very kind to give us a room. Want to let you know that September 15th and 16th of this year is the National Insider Risk Symposium in a town called Washington, D.C.
I've heard of that.
Save the date. They are already looking. It's the 11th annual Defense Strategies Institute. This is DSI West. That is just DSI, but make sure you, if you're interested in this space and you're willing to travel to Washington, D.C., which is a great town, come on out to DSI in September and maybe we'll do this again there.
Ooh, I like that idea. And it'll be here before we know it. September sounds really far away right now.
Don't speed bump through summer.
I'm sorry.
Don't speed bump through summer. I still got to get my flip-flops out and get there. All right. We'll talk to you all later.
The views and opinions presented herein are those of the interviewer and or interviewee and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or its components, including Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. Further, any reference to the use of specific resources or consultation with non-government personnel does not constitute endorsement by the Department of War, its components, or DCSA.